There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? I think we have to face it. People don't need just another piece of our mind, but they very much do need the piece of the mind of Christ. So you are just the person to give it to them. I invite you to connect with us online. Our website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. Let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter, at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, I gotta lead off with a confession. I mistakenly identified yesterday as the filing deadline for federal income tax reporting to the IRS. Actually, that day is today. Yesterday, come to find out, was actually a holiday in D.C., so the filing deadline, normally April the 15th, which this year fell on a Saturday, would have been pushed to Monday, but that was an official holiday in the District of Columbia because they were marking the anniversary of the end of slavery in that city. So curious that that holiday, celebrated on April the 16th, or the closest weekday to April the 16th, this year gives everyone a little more breathing room from the tax man. All right, so there you go. So no matter where you fall across the political spectrum, you have to pay taxes. If you're a Democrat, you probably enjoy paying taxes because you value all the government-funded programs that taxes provide for. If you're a Republican and you value smaller government and personal responsibility and entrepreneurship, today can feel, well, taxing. Well, there's something here upon which the widest spectrum of Americans actually agree. Gloria Steinem and Billy Graham actually agree on this particular point, so listen up. Gloria Steinem said, "We can tell your values by looking at your check stubs." And Billy Graham said, "Give me 5 minutes with a person's checkbook, and I will tell you where their heart is." Now, first of all, the first observation I need to make is these are old quotes. Few people have actual check stubs. Almost no one has an actual checkbook. Most millennials wouldn't even be able to identify what the kinds of paper that these two people are talking about. So it would really be helpful if someone out there would craft a quotable quote to say something that's culturally relevant but is on this same subject. So align your quote to say something like Gloria Steinem or Billy Graham has said in relationship to the values that we hold dear are actually reflected. The reality of those values is actually reflected in how we spend our money. Well, or we guess we could just turn to Jesus, because his quote, spoken a really long time ago, still holds out, bears true today. His quote, old but never dated, Jesus said, "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also," or "there your heart is also." So here's today's question. If someone took a look at the charitable giving itemization that you are reporting on your federal income tax returns, what would they learn about your heart? If someone were to look at your charitable giving itemization on your federal income tax returns, what would they learn about your heart? Now, if you're quick to respond that your tax returns are a private matter and they'll never see the light of day, well, it's kind of time to remind ourselves that everything done in secret is one day going to be brought to the light, and there's really nothing that's going on left hand or right hand that God is not privy to. And He's ultimately the one who is examining the heart. So I'm not asking this question because you're going to be, outed in the newspaper tomorrow. Your federal income tax returns are going to be, Rachel Maddow is going to do a big show exposing your 2005 tax returns or something. That's already been done. That's not what this is about. This is about where my heart is and how this process of accounting for my charitable giving every year actually gives me an opportunity to celebrate with the Father what He enabled me to do in the year that is now past, and then also to be challenged. How am I stewarding the resources that God has placed within my reach, under my management, for the advancement of His kingdom purposes in this generation? So take a look at your charitable giving itemization and consider maybe what God is calling you to do in this calendar year for His glory and the advancement of His kingdom purposes. So let's look just for a moment at Jesus's statement that where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. He actually says that in the context of what we know of as the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 through 7. And this verse appears in chapter 6, which starts off, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you're going to have no reward from your Father who is in heaven," which basically means don't be looking for like naming opportunities for your charitable giving. That's not what this is about. This is about giving to those ministries that are advancing the kingdom purposes of God in this generation and doing so where your left hand can't even see what your right hand is doing. Oh, which is what he says here. Okay, so verse 2. "Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, there, so that they can be praised by others. Truly I say to you, they've already received their reward. When you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you." Then Jesus offers up the Lord's Prayer in answer to the question of how should we pray, and then he returns to the subject of affection and how we invest ourselves in this world. So at verse 19 in chapter 6 of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." And then he says this, "The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body is going to be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." Now, he's not saying there you can't be rich and serve God, because obviously Solomon is a great example of a guy who was extraordinarily wealthy and also lived a life in some ways that was pleasing to the Lord. Now, not in all respects, because he got into all kinds of trouble. And Jesus actually turns to Solomon in this context of teaching. So picking up at verse 25, Jesus says, "Therefore, I tell you, don't be anxious about your life, what you're going to eat or what you're going to drink or your body, what you're going to put on. Is life not more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, being anxious, could add even a single hour to the span of his life?" We talked yesterday at the end of the program about Emma Morano, who lived for 117 years. She's the last person known to have lived in three different centuries. She was born in the 1800s. She lived throughout the full span of the 1900s, and she died in 2017. And even Emma Morano, if she'd been anxious and worrying about it, she couldn't have added a single hour to the span of her life. That's just not how this works. Jesus goes on to say, "Why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. And if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is today alive and tomorrow thrown into the oven, is he not going to much more clothe you? Oh, you of little faith. Therefore, do not be anxious. What shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear? The Gentiles seek after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all." Now get this. Then Jesus says, "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." That's not the prosperity gospel, my friends. That's the promise of kingdom living and the satisfaction that comes, the secret of being content in all circumstances, no matter what's going on. The secret of being content is this being so possessed of the Spirit of the living God that no matter what else is going on, I recognize that God is with me and for me and advancing his kingdom purposes in the context of whatever circumstances I happen to be facing. And Jesus' walk-off is this, in verse 34, "Therefore do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble." If you've ever heard anybody say, "Don't be borrowing trouble from tomorrow," that's where they get that saying. Here it is. It's Jesus saying, look, don't be anxious about tomorrow. Tomorrow has got enough anxiety for itself. Sufficient for the day is the trouble therein. Like, today's got enough trouble for today. Don't be borrowing trouble from tomorrow. And so, yes, it's tax day. And yes, I think that we should consider filing our taxes a privilege of democracy. And as you pay your taxes, I encourage you to do so with an attitude of gratitude. I encourage you to do so in an attitude of reflective prayer, that God has supplied you with the opportunity to work, and that work has been is a labor that has yielded a reward, and that you have then in turn been able to re-sow that reward into the lives of others to advance God's kingdom purposes. And in terms of your charitable giving, what do your tax filings reveal about the true status of your heart? As we turn to the international news, I want you to keep the last verse that we just talked about in full view. Jesus said, "Do not be anxious about tomorrow, because sufficient for the day is its own trouble." All right, so after 100 years of democratic governance, the nation of Turkey seems to be returning itself to an autocratic, if not Islamic, state. So just a few days ago now, we actually had the opportunity to talk with Senator Lankford from Oklahoma. Part of that conversation centered on what's going on in Turkey and his observations about that. Now, this conversation took place prior to the referendum this weekend, but I want you to hear again the evaluation of Senator Lankford on the situation in Turkey.
"And I can no longer encourage Americans to go to Turkey and to be able to practice business, because there is unknown whether you're going to just be held without charges indefinitely. And it is a major concern long-term for any American now traveling to Turkey."
All right, friends. So if that was the seriousness of the situation before this weekend vote, it's even more serious now. And why do I say that? Well, to recap what happened over the weekend, Turkey's president, Erdogan, has declared victory in a referendum that has actually expanded his presidential powers. So Turkey became a republic in 1923. You have to remember that for many hundreds of years, Turkey was actually not Turkey. It just became Turkey after a guy named Ataturk helped move it out of the era of the Ottoman Empire and into what we would understand as a representative democracy of sorts. Okay, so it became a republic in 1923. So there's not even a 100-year history of democracy in this country. Prior to that, it was a full-blown Islamic state under what we know as the Ottoman Empire. Well, this move over the weekend by President Erdogan moves, I would say, Turkey back into the direction of not only an autocracy, an autocratic state, but also, because of his own viewpoints on things, indeed an Islamic state. The president said that the constitutional amendments that were approved by a narrow margin in a referendum this weekend would give him tools to grapple with terrorism, economic woes, and conflict in neighboring Syria. However, in the short term, they are likely to create some level of instability. Here is basically what a yes vote means for Turkey's government. There is now an executive presidency exercising sole power. So here in the United States, we have three branches, three co-equal branches of government. We have executive, we have legislative, and we have judicial. And those three are intended to be co-equal, and they're all subject to the consent of the governed, the will of the people. It's a government by the people, for the people, and of the people, right? It's the people's government. That's what we've got here in the United States. That is really different than what Turkey now has, and then increasingly will have as these amendments to the Constitution take effect. So this has got this new executive presidency, which will be exercising sole power, and the post of prime minister will be abolished. The president will now unilaterally appoint vice presidents without any parliamentary approval. The president will have the power to appoint and dismiss cabinet ministers with no need for parliamentary approval, and the cabinet reports exclusively and directly to the president. The president has the power to select judges and actually to reorganize the judiciary should he see fit. He has the power to dissolve parliament on any grounds. Now, I got to tell you, that would be pretty staggering. I mean, just imagine in an executive order if the president of the United States could just dissolve Congress and reseat whoever he wanted on the judicial bench. The president in Turkey will now be responsible for national security as its commander-in-chief. And then the parliament is also going to be widely expanded to 600 members. The list goes on and on and on of the constitutional amendments as it's going to take place. Here's the concern. The concern is that as power is consolidated under one individual, although stability might increase, freedom does not. There is a trade-off that happens. And at least 50% of the population in Turkey seems willing to risk the trade-off of greater security, greater stability, for a decreased level of freedom. Now, that trade-off between freedom and stability is important for us to keep in mind. And it's also really important for us to keep in mind, we do not understand all of the complexities on the ground in the Middle East. We just don't. We don't live there. We don't have a world view that is consistent with the Middle East. We don't have a Middle Eastern mindset. And so when you and I look at, let's say, the situation in Turkey, we look at it as members of a democracy that values pluralism and freedom of thought and freedom of religious expression. None of those things are supported in Turkey already. Okay, so we're not talking about the kind of democracy that we experience here in the United States, nor the level of freedom that we enjoy. And we look across the border into Syria, and we say, well, there, it's really easy. Everyone surely is in agreement that that Assad is a bad guy. Surely, on the ground, it doesn't really matter who you are. Your assessment of Assad is that he's a bad guy. And here's the challenge. That's actually not the viewpoint of some people on the ground in Syria, particularly Christians. And so when we talk about having a Christian worldview on something, we talk about trying to understand a situation on the ground halfway around the world, it's important to listen to what Christians in those places are actually saying. Now, Christians in Turkey, I have nothing nice to say right now about Erdogan and his treatment of Christians in Turkey, since we continue to be concerned about and appeal for the release of Andrew Brunson, who is an evangelical Presbyterian church missionary and pastor who's been in Turkey for 25 years, serving God and serving the people of Turkey there. And he has been wrongfully imprisoned in Turkey by President Erdogan since October. So I don't have anything nice to say about the treatment of Christians in Turkey. However, if you look across the border in Syria, where we would almost universally condemn Assad as a bad guy, we are hearing from Christians there that although he's a bad guy, actually they describe it this way, certainly not an angel, that he's better possibly than the alternatives that they face if Assad is set aside or pushed aside or assassinated or whatever the options would be. So here's some of the things that they're talking about. The international perception of Assad is that he's a monster or a dictator. But folks on the ground there say, look, we are living at ease. This is the language. We are living at ease under this particular strongman. And so it's a challenge for us to imagine that somebody would prefer, that a Christian would prefer living under the tyranny of a madman like Assad, because they actually fear, they have a greater fear of who would replace him, which in their case may well be ISIS. And so here's the quote in this particular article. If you have to choose between ISIS and Assad, well, we choose Assad, says a Greek Catholic Archbishop Jean Clement of Aleppo. It seems sometimes all the countries of the world are against Assad, but we feel we don't have any other alternative. Honest to God, this is the situation. So I think that as we are praying for what's happening globally, and as we are acknowledging that we do not understand the on-the-ground reality for a lot of folks in a lot of places, let's be the people who are mindful of the complexity of the situation, and let's be praying for and acting on behalf of our Christian brothers and sisters who are in these places. Let's obviously continue to appeal in every way that we have the power to do so, both to our Lord in heaven and to our government here on earth. for humanitarian aid and for opportunities for those who want to leave the region to leave, and for those who want to stay in the region, that we would equip them, we would equip Christians in those regions to be able to stay. All right, quickly from one international hotspot to another, I feel like we got to touch on North Korea. Just yesterday, President Trump said North Korea, well, they've got to behave. And we are now at the place where the game plan of the Obama administration, which was strategic patience, has obviously not been effective. North Korea is advancing both their nuclear bomb technology and the ability to deliver those bombs globally via what are called ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. And evidence of all of that has come out over, you know, the last several weeks, during which they've been test firing at least six missiles. So all of this is going on. Mike Pence, our vice president, said yesterday that the United States is going to ditch the whole strategic patience plan. And North Korea responded by saying that, quote, thermonuclear war may break out at any moment. Now, on this particular point, let me say again, Jesus has reminded us not to borrow trouble from tomorrow. All right. Today's concerns, today's issues have enough anxiety for today. And so for those of you who remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, I would describe this as like similar to that, only taking place in very slow motion over a very long period of time. There's no sense that no one seems to have a sense that that North Korea is currently in a position to deliver a nuclear capable weapon to even into the airspace of the United States. But that seems to be the growing concern over time. So in order to understand this particular complex situation, I think that we would also have to not have a Middle Eastern worldview, which is the conversation we need to have when we're talking about Turkey and when we're talking about Syria. We'd actually have to have an Asian worldview. We'd actually have to understand the Asian mindset as being very different from the mindset here in the United States and even in the Western world. And you're talking here about a culture where guilt and shame are the operating. It's a shame culture being a very different kind of culture than the sort of guilt and innocence mindset here in the West. So here in the West, we have this sort of a, you know, there's a right and wrong, guilt and innocence. They're the innocent, they're the guilty, and we're very individualistic. People who break laws are guilty, and in the Eastern cultures, it's more of a shame honor situation. Okay, and there's more of a collective mindset. So people are shamed for not fulfilling group expectations. And so they would seek to restore their honor before the community. And so you would never publicly embarrass someone. And you would also, it would not be accurate to say that someone is, well, thinking about doing the right thing. I think when the president says of President Xi in China, I think he wants to do the right thing. Well, China is an Asian mindset culture. He's not thinking about right and wrong, guilt and innocence. He's thinking about honor, honor and shame, or shame and honor. And so it's more what would honor the relationship, what would honor the people. And so in shame and honor cultures, there's something called face. So to understand the culture, you have to understand the face. So to dishonor someone publicly is actually the biggest insult you can give, right? So we save face. So I just think that we have to lift this up because I think that we get so caught up in our Western way of thinking about things that we forget that other people around the world don't actually look at the world through the same lens that we do. And we're not just talking here about a Christian or a biblical worldview. We're talking about a regional worldview, a worldview that grows up out of the culture in which a person is born and raised. So there's some great articles on these concepts of honor and shame and understanding guilt and shame. Ed Stetzer actually posted an article in March of 2015 on the Christianity Today website. It's called Four Keys to Evangelism in an Honor Shame Culture. I would recommend that to you. Hey, friends, this is The Reconnect. It's a listener-supported program. You can go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and support the ministry. We got to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'm going to be talking with Marvin Alasky. He's the editor-in-chief of World News Group. You're not going to want to miss it. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back.
to a needy soul, but don't have love, then who is poor, it seems? All the poverty is found in me. So let my life be the proof of your love. Let my love look like you and what you're made of.
Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, and we are seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. So one of the ways that we help equip you to be an effective ambassador of Jesus Christ in the world today is that we talk with the people who help us understand what's happening in the world. Marvin Olasky is the editor-in-chief of World News Group. If you don't already currently, you should be reading along and subscribing to World Magazine at world.wng.org. Marvin is the distinguished chair in journalism and public policy at Patrick Henry College. He's the author of more than 20 books, including The Tragedy of American Compassion. And you can follow him on Twitter at Marvin Olasky. Marvin, welcome to The Reconnect.
Good to be with you, Carmen.
So in the heart of every Christian is this Christ compassion, this desire to care for others. And the Bible certainly affirms that true religion is that we would take care of widows and orphans in their distress. So what's the disconnect when government begins, let's say, confiscating personal property in the form of taxes even, for redistribution to those in the society who are considered needy? How does that erode Christian opportunity or the Christian motivation to give?
Well, lots of congregations are involved in helping the poor for exactly the reason you mentioned. And, you know, they rightly want to put, as you say, God in the middle of every conversation. But let's talk about the conversation that there's been in politics over the past several decades. Let's say Democrats often say, well, these people who are poor cannot help themselves. They really can't do anything. We don't want to let them stay in misery, and so we're going to give them $20,000 or $23,000 a year. And then Republicans come along and say, well, yeah, I think you're basically right, but that's too much. And so we'll give them $10,000 or $13,000 a year. And that's where the battle has been. But the real question is, since we know that God created us after His own image. God is the creator. He created the world in 6 days. We are also capable of creativity. We're capable of work. We're in God's image. And if you take a person who's in God's image and is capable of working, and you say, well, gee, I can give you $23,000 a year, I can give you $13,000 a year, that's really not the right debate. The right debate is, what can you do? What are you capable of doing? What can we help train you to do? How can we help you actually be working and creating and be on your feet in that way and thus able to help others? And that's the conversation for the most part in America that we're not having in political circles.
So how do we move from the conversation that we are having to that conversation?
Well, I think we start looking at the welfare system that exists and saying, what is there that's needed? For example, medical care in our society is important and crucial, and that's something that a variety of governmental bodies and lots of private charities provide. That's important. So we're not going to take that off the table. We're not going to say, gee, congregations can start providing all medical care themselves. But when it comes to working at jobs and getting job training, this is something that people in churches actually know very well because a lot of people work, a lot of people have businesses, a lot of people really want to help out. And so we start saying, what can we do to help those people help more? Rather than, let's say, you know, this is tax time, rather than sending tens of thousands of dollars to Washington, can we keep some of that money in our own neighborhoods and spend that for the good of people who need help by providing jobs? That's the key question. And one simple proposal in this that's been around for years and it's never gotten traction is let people in filling out income taxes start at a pretty low amount, basically, given all the tens of thousands of dollars for each person that go towards the welfare system. Let's just start with $1,000. When you fill out your 1040, you can just say, okay, I want to, instead of sending $1,000 to Health and Human Services, I want to give that money to a church group or charity in my own area that I know is doing much better with that $1,000 than people in Washington would do. I can give that $1,000 to that charity. I can take that right off my taxes. I'll provide the evidence that I've done that with checks and so forth. And then the local groups, the churches, the charities, the groups that are helping people gain skills will have $1,000 more from each taxpayer to work with. That'll start changing the balance. Instead of shifting everything to Washington, that'll start changing the balance and letting people in churches do much more.
Well, so okay, Marvin, I'll play the devil's advocate here. So that sounds like we're going to actually, you know, place some level of trust in charitable, maybe even religious organizations in our local communities that would then be taking the place of government welfare programs. And, you know, doesn't the government do all of these things better than churches ever could? Could you just speak to that conversation?
Yeah, and that's where we have to go at ground level. That's what we try to do in World Magazine rather than theorize about it. We want to go out and report what's actually happening. We had a cover story a couple of issues ago about homelessness in Los Angeles and San Diego and what's going on there. So we actually tried to see what's happening at ground level. I did a lot of that myself as a reporter in the 1990s. Now I'm working as an editor with World, and we have reporters doing that, going out and finding that for the most part, government money distributed to people who are capable of working doesn't help. It actually works. It actually hurts. It hurts them by saying, just sit there, don't do anything, we'll give you money, instead of saying, oh, you're capable of doing much more, we're going to help you do that, we're going to make sure you don't starve, we're going to make sure that you, when you're working, that you're not homeless, but once you're willing to work, we're going to do everything possible we can to help you become on your feet, self-sustaining, and capable of helping others. And that's the crucial message. We're not just takers, we can be givers, and that's what churches really do. It often requires a change in thinking. Instead of a person just thinking, what am I going to do today and tomorrow and the next day? It may require a person to start thinking, well, what am I going to do next month and 6 months from now and a year from now? That long-range thinking is what Christians actually are very good at. We tend to think long-range, and we can help other people do that, but we need to have a chance to do that. We can't just say, okay, we pay our taxes, government's going to take care of it. You know, at ground level, you talk to social workers. They have hundreds of cases. They are just besieged. The people are numbers to them. What really helps is when individual church members, groups of them, can provide challenging and personal and spiritual help to people in need. And at ground level, we have seen that changes lives.
Hey, friends, we're talking with Marvin Olasky. He's the editor-in-chief of World News Group. You should be checking them out at World Magazine. You can follow Marvin on Twitter at Marvin Olasky. Let's talk about how you would answer Bernie Sanders' charge during the Democratic primary debate, where he said, I mean, essentially, we are not a compassionate country. Can you speak to that?
There's a fellow named Arthur Brooks, who's the head of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, who's actually done a lot of research on that question. And in one sense, Bernie is right. We're not a compassionate country because all of us aren't. The federal government isn't particularly compassionate. It may spend money, but that's not suffering with people. That's the meaning of compassion. And there are lots of people who aren't. Arthur's research showed that religious conservatives are compassionate people for the most part. Again, there are exceptions, but you just look at the amount of money and time that religious conservatives, and this is primarily Christians, contribute, they are number one in our society in being compassionate. The least compassionate actually are secular liberals like Bernie Sanders, because they say, well, we don't want to be compassionate because government should do it. We want to send our money to Washington and have Washington do it. And again, that's where you have to, at ground level, see what's actually helping and what's hurting. So the most compassionate are religious conservatives. Second in line are religious liberals, I mean, who do have a faith, and they may be misplaced in some way, but they'll work through their churches. There are liberal organizations of Christians who do a lot. I don't think it's all that effective necessarily, but they do a lot. They care. They are compassionate. They are willing to suffer with people. The least helpful in that way are conservatives, whether they're are secular conservatives or secular liberals. Liberals tend to, on the secular side, want to. They actually will say that churches get in the way, because then people will think you can do stuff through your churches rather than going through government. So that's what Arthur's research shows. The most compassionate are religious conservatives. The least compassionate are secular liberals.
So I don't have it up in front of me, but I know I read recently, just in the last couple of days, from Gallup, that something like 40% of 5th to 12th graders who they polled actually want to start a business. Like, they're entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. They want to do that.
Right.
So I'm thinking that there's a good point of intersection for what you're talking about. I think that people in churches may be less afraid of, hey, engaging kids and cultivating with kids, that entrepreneurial spirit and mentoring kids, then it's a little scary. It's a little somehow more scary to think of somebody who's my own age doing that with them. And I don't know why that is, but I think when you talk about long-term strategy, when you talk about looking long-term, when you talk about generational impact, maybe churches could key in on what Gallup, says they have discovered. 40% of 5th to 12th graders, that's a lot of kids. And maybe that would be a group that we could move in the direction of not only job training and jobs, but actually helping them start small businesses.
Well, that's absolutely right. Now, fifth grade is typically when some kids in bad schools and bad situations, often without dads in their home, that's when they tend to go downhill. And it happens more quickly with boys than with girls. And very often there's no adult at all who's actually really paying attention to them, loving them, teaching them. So I've seen groups, right here in Austin, we have a group called Community New Start that works with a couple of public schools. And these are public schools where kids are greatly in danger, poor public schools and poor neighborhoods. And there are individuals who one-to-one will spend not just one tutoring session, but commit to spending at least a year, sometimes more, working with one child, helping the child read, helping the child learn arithmetic, and then sometimes helping a child start to learn about being in a business. I've seen fifth graders standing up who started a T-shirt business, and very proudly they'll say, here's one of my T-shirts. This cost me $4 to make, and I sold it for $8. Wow. And here was money in my pocket. That makes a big impression on kids. But what it takes very often are adults who are willing to spend time with them. We have every year in World, this is our 12th year we're doing it, a Hope Award for Effective Compassion, where we go around the country and look at groups and see which ones are really helping. And, there have been award winners, one called Dads in the Fields in the West, and lots of others that actually do this one-to-one work with kids, helping them become pioneers, helping them build businesses, but fundamentally helping them read and do arithmetic, because when kids fall behind there, that's when they become discouraged, and it gets worse and worse as time goes on. So, yeah, fifth grade is the crucial time for intervention. It's really hard with homeless adults. It works sometimes, but it works much more with kids, and that would be the place I would suggest any individual or any church to begin with, fifth and sixth grade kids.
All right, before we let you go, I got to change gears for just a second. Tell me about the first show that's going to take place on stage when the Museum of the Bible opens in D.C. in November.
Oh, yeah, I just wrote something yesterday about...
I know, it's just yesterday, so I figured it would be top of mind.
Yeah, thank you for reading it. 10 years ago, in New York City, I ran across a guy who had been a church youth group director, a policeman, but he always loved Broadway and had all these tunes in his head. And he started writing, this is 20 years ago, a musical about John Newton, the slave trader who became a pastor and a great crusader against slavery and wrote Amazing Grace. And he developed the music for this musical called Amazing Grace. It was very slow and going. Just after 8 years, it made it to Broadway. It started in Connecticut and Chicago, made it to Broadway, was there for a few months. The people who went and loved it. Some of the music critics did not like it. It closed. It's been down for a year and a half now. But when the Museum of the Bible in Washington is opening up in November, Amazing Grace is going to be the first thing on this big new stage they have. That'll be there for a couple of months, and that'll start a nationwide tour. I'm not an agent for the for Chris, the composer, or the others. I just love the story of a guy who persevered, and it's going to have its Washington debut in November, right off the mall near Capitol Hill.
I know. It's so exciting. So I couldn't have been more excited to read this short piece that you posted yesterday at World Magazine. Folks, again, if you go to world.wng.org, you can read what Marvin Olasky is writing. You can follow him on Twitter at Marvin Olasky. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Reconnect.
Thank you, Carmen. God in the middle of everything. That's a great slogan.
Well,
every conversation. Thanks.
In the middle, we want him in the middle of every conversation. That's right. All right, friends, this is the point in the show where we go below the fold. We like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start and engage with others in conversations that may not initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles could change not only the conversation, but potentially the course of another person's thinking. And if you can change the way a person thinks, man, you can really impact how they live. So I was actually tempted, like many others, a few days ago to lift up this story. And this is now evidence a couple of days later that sometimes waiting on something that seems almost too unbelievable to be true, sometimes waiting a couple of days, well, you find out that the story was a hoax to begin with. So the story is about a married couple in Mississippi who supposedly discovered that they are biological twins during a pursuit of in vitro fertilization. Now, this story turns out to be fake. So this is fake news from a fake news site. And in this fake news story, the doctors at a fertility lab noticed that the DNA of the husband and wife was abnormally similar. So here's why I want to lift this up. First of all, if a story is too outrageous to be believed, it may be because it's not true. So let's start with that. Let's also wonder to ourselves why some very reputable news organizations around the world actually picked up the story and ran it as news. And those of us who read those reputable news sources would have seen it there, and we would not have known that they picked it up from a ultimately fake news website. So here is part of the challenge in listening to and being a consumer of news today. You can't take any of it really at face value. I mean, I think that if you're seeing a story attested to by multiple reporters who have multiple sources who they are quoting, and there's some verifiable, there's a verifiable line of evidence, then you can be like, all right, now I've heard it, I've heard it in three different places, I've read it in six different places, and everybody is kind of echoing one another and saying at least similar things, even if from different viewpoints and with different biases. So that's part of it. The other thing would be, don't just forward on social media anything that attracts your attention. Okay, it's called clickbait for a reason. And so if there's something that is so provocative that you think to yourself, wow, that's so hard to believe, I wouldn't encourage you, if you are able to do so, to actually check out the website that is behind it. In this particular case, the website behind all of this is something called the Mississippi Herald, which sounds like a real place and a real newspaper. But in fact, the Mississippi Herald website was only registered in November. It contains no reporter bylines, no physical address, and no contact information beyond an online form that essentially goes nowhere. So the fake news that is posted there uses pictures and articles that certainly sound and look legitimate, but the stories behind the headlines are entirely fictional. Now, some of these fake news websites are there to entertain and amuse. Others are there to peddle their own agendas. They're all there certainly to make money, and they make money by people clicking on and then creating a social media viral effect of their stories, which in this case was actually effective. This story actually did go viral, which means that a lot of people on social media posted it, forwarded it, commented on it, all of those kinds of things. So we could actually deal with the with the substance of the issue behind this article and why it is that so many people found it so provocative that they not only clicked on it, but they commented on it and forwarded it via their own social platforms to other people. And here's the reason. So if you just sat and talked through the initial article with anyone, which we did here in our office, and if you talked through it with somebody, you say to yourself, well, at some point during their early dating, did the fact that they were born on the same day and that they're both raised in adoptive households because their parents died in a car crash when they were infants, like at some point, and apparently all of their friends tell them how much they look alike, at some point, don't you do your own research and say, is it possible that this is a person to whom I'm biologically related? So that just seems like the reasonable thing reasonable people would do. But the second part of this is a conversation about IVF, right? This opens up another opportunity for you to have a conversation with others about IVF. Like, as a Christian, where are you at on that? And because this is a fake news story, because this is not a real couple, because this is a situation where the substance of the story is fake, it makes it easier to talk about IVF in this particular conversation because it's not a reality for this couple. I mean, because it's not a real couple, because it's not a real story. So I can say, okay, so let's actually then just talk about IVF. Like, as a Christian, where am I at on that? If there are reasons that two people are not able to naturally conceive a child, is the conversation as Christians that we should be encouraging them to have, is the conversation about adoption. There's hundreds of thousands of orphans here in the United States. There's certainly millions of orphans globally. So it's not that there are not children available for adoption, that there are not children who need homes. I recognize that there is some biological desire to have your own offspring, but I think that as Christians, we have to be having a conversation about IVF in particular. Okay, why? Because in IVF, we are producing more. In every case of which I am aware, we are producing more fertilized eggs, more embryos, more people than are ever actually going to be gestated in the womb of the mother and brought to, brought into life as a child. And so when we destroy those embryos, what are we doing? What are we doing? What is that? And if you are a pro-life person, is that not abortion? And if it is abortion, then you're not a pro-life person. And you cannot have it both ways. This is a conversation that you cannot have both ways. And so I think that when we have a fake news story, when we have a non-existent hypothetical couple, and it's already in the news and people are already talking about it, it enables us to have the secondary conversation about a really complicated subject matter that is intensely emotional for a lot of people, but we can do so about a couple that's not real and about a situation that is, in fact, a hoax, an ethical dilemma for sure, but a hoax nonetheless. All right, folks, this radio ministry is brought to you by a national ministry called the Presbyterian Lay Committee. And we are privileged to bring this ministry to you every day. We are privileged to bring it to you in this one-hour daily format. We're privileged to bring it to you in a one-minute format we call Reconnect One. And if you want more information about any of that, come to our website at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'd love for you to become a partner in this ministry as we seek to reach more and more people. All right, friends, reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.